Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LeCain. One of the great challenges of our time is wealth inequality. The wealth gap is large and growing. The top 1% owns more wealth than 90% of the rest of us combined. It may seem inevitable that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, but a closer look tells a different story. The rules of the game are stacked in favor of the wealthy. Those with wealth benefit by massive subsidies and tax breaks, not set in stone, but established in laws passed by Congress. Those laws can be changed. Both our guests today are dedicated to finding ways to increase prosperity for all. Our first guest is Amanda Fisher, Policy Director of the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. Following her will be Chuck Collins, Director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies. First up is Amanda Fisher, Policy Director of the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. Amanda worked for more than a decade on Capitol Hill in roles for leading members of Congress, including Representative Katie Porter, Representative Maxine Waters, and Senator Sherrod Brown. Amanda Fisher, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you so much for inviting me to talk today.
Yeah. So first off, how concentrated is wealth in America?
So, I mean, as you said, just in your opening remarks, it is tremendously concentrated. It is at levels, you know, not seen since the Gilded Age. And it's been on a trajectory getting worse for the last 40 years. So a recent statistic that came out from a study by the RAND Corporation showed that if we had the same distribution of income that we had right after World War II, the median household in the United States would be earning $90,000 to $100,000 per year now. Instead, the median household income just before the pandemic hit was around $50,000 a year. So there's been tremendous growth across our economy. It just has not been widely shared.
Right. And you spent a lot of time on Capitol Hill. Do you think, what are the reasons why that enormous growth and, you know, we got the world's richest country here, but why isn't that being more widely shared like it was after World War II?
So, you know, as you said earlier, I think we really need to emphasize that this is a political choice that we are making. It is not the inevitable result of globalization or technology, the robots coming to take our jobs. It is the laws that we put in place to govern how our economy operates. And in the last 40 years, we've seen a pretty concerted diminution in worker power. So the decline of unions, the decline of workplace protections, the tax code being rigged against people who work for a living versus people who get investment income for a living. We've seen the decline of antitrust policies, so companies are allowed to get larger, merge and have combinations that make them more powerful. And then that economic power translates to the ability to hoard political power, which forms a self-reinforcing cycle as those who have money and resources are able to consolidate that into changing the rules to benefit themselves.
Right. And you understood this apparently going in to work on Capitol Hill because you picked with, I would say, some of the best people in the House and the Senate who understand this and are really working hard to be champions of working families. What did you experience while you were on the Hill? What did you learn about? What are we really up against here? It just would seem like most people would benefit by the kinds of changes you're talking about. And yet champions like Sherrod Brown and Maxine Waters and Katie Porter, you know, they try valiantly and yet have kind of limited success in shaping the tax code, for example, and other policies to be more in favor of working families. What did you learn about what we're up against and what do you think we can do to overcome it?
So first, I would say I'm actually a great believer in Congress. I think it's the best institution that we have. And I think that the deep polarization among elected members of Congress reflects deep polarization among the American people. Now, certainly, you know, the rules are stacked against working people in the halls of Congress also. We see voter suppression. We see the rise of corporate power and the ability to influence elections and get their issues heard. And we see a media that amplifies certain stories about palace intrigue or personality conflicts over the struggles that working people are facing every day. So, you know, it's a lot to overcome, but I will say the 2018 election really showed the power that some of these messages can have, particularly right now, even before the pandemic. So I'm a believer that you know, this moment, as dire as it is, as challenging as it is, it's really an opportunity to look at the systemic change that we need to make our economy and make families more resilient coming out of this pandemic.
Exactly right. And you just wrote a powerful briefing on kind of the disconnect now between, we've got small businesses closing, but large corporations, most of them are fine. I mean, there's a few spectacular closings like Disneyland recently, but we've got this kind of disconnect where small businesses are closing, a lot of people are laid off, but the big businesses, most of them so far, have been doing well, and the stock market is at an all-time high. So how do you explain that disconnect?
Yeah, so, you know, Vice President Pence last night at the debate said that the United States is about to experience a V-shaped recovery, meaning that things went south really quickly, but he believes that they're going to come back really quickly as well. And that's not actually what we're seeing. We're seeing something that more closely looks like a K-shaped recovery, which means that the fates of those at the top are really diverging from the fates of everybody else. And we see this play out both at a household level and at a business level. So, you know, wealthier households that are able to work from home have not really seen their income collapse during this pandemic. Purchases of luxury goods are up. And, you know, white Americans are doing a lot better than Black Americans and Hispanic Americans. And then on a business level, we're seeing that same bifurcation there. So companies that are able to rely on stock and bond markets in order to fund themselves, to meet their payroll, to buy supplies, are doing okay. Smaller businesses that have to rely on bank loans or are waiting for paycheck protection help from the government are doing a lot less well. In fact, one in five small businesses doesn't believe that they will, you know, be alive in the next 6 months. And in fact, we saw 11% of small businesses close even before the first of the mandatory lockdowns came down, just because demand constricted so much. But the, you know, silver lining to all of this is that public policy can stop this. There is no reason why we cannot take public health measures to keep everyone safe and then help small businesses and help people weather the pandemic by, you know, supporting their income.
Right. And fortunately, we have an election November 3rd and a chance to get some new leadership, both in the White House and in Congress. We're hoping to send some more companions to Sherrod Brown and Katie Porter, get some real more leading lights and champions of working people in there. But if you know, you're so smart, you've got a great education and a lot of experience, what would you say, like, what are the top policies that we need to be following, you know, when hopefully we get Democrats in control of the House and the Senate and the White House, you know, what should we be fighting for? We have to deal with both the immediate crisis of the pandemic and the long-term, as you say, the slide since World War II of more of the wealth going towards the upper tier. So what would you say we need to do right now?
I mean, immediately, the public health crisis is at the center of everything. It's obviously dire because people continue to die. And it's also dire because it affects our economy. And even in states or localities that have reopened, quote unquote, people are still not going out and spending the way that they used to because they need to have confidence that they're not going to get sick. So first and foremost is getting the public health crisis under control. And then in the meantime, we really need to just support people's income. So the $600 bonus in unemployment benefits that expired over the summer, you know, it needs to be renewed. We need to get money in people's pockets so that they can keep spending, keep making their basic needs. And that a downturn caused by a pandemic does not spiral into a downturn caused by macroeconomic conditions, people not having enough money to spend. So, you know, I would put that front and center. And then longer term, I think we're really seeing the hollowing out of public institutions over the last four decades. So, you know, we saw it took people forever to get their unemployment insurance benefits because the systems were made to be broken. Mm-hmm. You know, it took some people weeks and weeks to cash their direct payment checks because not everyone has access to a bank account. And a lot of people had to pay fees to, you know, check cashers or payday lenders in order to get the money that they were owed. So across the board, I think we really need to have a renewed focus on building our resiliency, building infrastructure to make sure that we have these supports that can keep everyone safe and keep our economy growing even in the face of challenges.
Right. That sounds like a good plan. I hope you're advising Vice President Biden. He's going to need a lot of help when he gets in there. We're hoping he gets in there. Do you support a wealth tax?
You know, my organization has studied this deeply, and I think we already have a wealth tax. It's called property taxes, and expanding that to, you know, non-property forms of wealth is a way to really tackle the concentration of resources at the top. So right now, I think deficit spending is fine. I think we need to do that to support our economy. I think the cost of inaction far outweigh the cost of growing the deficit right now, but long-term, if we do need revenue, I think that that's a great source of it, both because it can raise a lot of money, but also because it challenges the entrenched political power that resides at the top. And that is also essential in order to move towards an economy that serves everyone better.
Yeah. You know, I've talked to some working people and they think it's unfair to tax the wealthy more. I mean, these are people who, like a guy working at a car rental shop, for example, and he's staunch Republican, wouldn't vote for Elizabeth Warren or any Democrat because he thinks it's unfair to tax people who are wealthy more. It's like penalizing success is kind of the talking point. What's your response to that?
You know, I have these conversations with family members a lot, and you know, they get upset about what they perceive as benefits flowing to undeserving people. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing that I try to explain to them with really everyday examples that I saw in my career on Capitol Hill is how their pockets are getting picked by people at the top without them even noticing it. It's because of entrenched political power, the rewriting of the rules is allowed to happen. And, you know, that skims just a little bit of income off of every single person. So I worked in the banking space for most of my career. When we saw the foreclosure crisis hit, nobody could get through, including my own family, to get a loan modification from the bank when they were in distress. That deliberate underinvestment in those systems so that you cannot process loan modifications, that's a choice. That's a choice to save money and not serve the customers. And, you know, we've made the cost of doing business, the fines that they receive, you know, just a slap on the wrist compared to the cost to actually build a resilient system. It happens everywhere. When you swipe your card at a gas station, the toll that you have to pay to banks does not need to be that high. It's not that high in other countries. Again, it is just invisible pickpocketing that happens every day with the rules being rewritten by those in power. So I really try to expose those examples and try to reframe it as having fair competition, having real capitalism where people play by the same set of rules, which is not something that I think we have across the board now.
Right, exactly right. And I had a professor in law school who said, really, if you're interested in government, you need to understand taxes. It's all about, it's tax and budget is the whole game. And I think part of the problem is taxes. You know, you see people's eyes glaze over when you talk about the like 3,000 page tax code that we've got and so forth, all that. And yet you have things like the, if we would scrap the cap on the Social Security income tax, so that, you know, right now, whatever it is you pay a certain percentage up to, I think it's what, $148,000 a year. But then after that, you're kind of scot-free. So people who make a lot of money pay no more. People who earn $1 million or $5 million are paying the same towards the Social Security as someone who's earning around $150,000. So, but I think that's, I think you're exactly right. It's kind of the money is being distorted in a way, or taken from working people in a way that's not really visible to them. So, but then they see maybe a handout to the poor, or the, you know, the right wing is certainly putting that image in front of them a lot. So that's a more visible thing. And they worried, hey, I work hard for my money. So I think that, you know, in terms of the mindset in the country, I think that's part of how the right wing Republicans have gotten away with this massive shift that I've seen since World War II, where it was a more equitable taxing system. But since 1950, more and more of the tax burden has been shifted away from the wealthy corporations and the individuals onto the backs of working people. Would you agree?
Yeah, and I think I'd be remiss to not describe how this is a really racialized phenomenon. So there's a lot of scholarship, a lot of people that have studied this. And as soon as African Americans gained legal access to all of our institutions, as court cases came down and, you know, said separate but not equal was unconstitutional, we've really seen a retreat from public institutions. So it is those public institutions that built the American middle class. Our housing policy, the creation of FHA mortgages really built the suburbs. Our transportation policy built the suburbs by constructing the highway system. We had the GI Bill. Union membership was a lot stronger, but unions were highly segregated. And we've seen a real retreat from all of those public institutions that made America the economic powerhouse that it has been. And that's really come lockstep with, Black people gaining access to these institutions, and lockstep with more and more power and money being hoarded at the top.
Right. Good point. And we know part of the resilience you're talking about that we need has been where in the United States, it was believed you had a good idea, you put some hard work, a little bit of money, you start a business, you start employing people, you make money. What do you see happening, what it is? It's mostly that with some big corporations, or are we kind of entering an era where a huge part of the jobs are really in the big companies?
Yeah, I'm really concerned about a collapse in small business coming out of this recession, and then what our economy looks like afterwards. So we know that 1 in 5 small business owners don't expect to survive this pandemic. We know that the PPP loans that were available, the smaller of a business you are, the less likely you were to receive them. There was not enough money to go around. The money ran out in 2 weeks before Congress came back and gave more money. And we know because that money was sent through the banking system, through bank, people had to apply for banks, all the problems in the banking system in terms of discrimination and access got overlaid on top of the coronavirus pandemic. So I'm definitely concerned about that. We know that recessions are particularly hard for small business. During the great financial crisis, we saw the largest number of closures in small business since the data began being collected. And now during the COVID pandemic, we've already seen small business closures equal to the 4-year period of the great financial crisis of a decade ago. So it's pretty dire now. And it's one thing I've been studying deeply is how our Federal Reserve System and some of the bailout programs that they've engineered are designed to be efficient and at scale and help buoy the stock in the bond markets, but we don't have a similar set of infrastructure to help small business. So they have to wait weeks for the money. They may not receive the money. There's a complexity tax. They need lawyers and accountants to access the money. And that imbalance is really going to make this recovery lopsided, I fear. And what we saw after the last crisis is that private equity barons came in and bought up all the single family real estate when people got foreclosed on. And now there's a lot of people that rent from private equity companies, you know, as their form of housing. And I'm afraid we're going to see that happen again in this crisis, where a few large players that have large stashes of cash are going to be able to buy up a bunch of businesses and consolidate even further.
Yeah. And it's kind of like what you talked about, you know, it's kind of going in like that. The people who are have a lot of money already can get great services, lots of attention, speedy, easy. People without money, you know, go wait in line at the bank and no personal, you know, customized service to help you. It's just like everything seems to go the elite at the top and then the struggling majority is the rest of the people. And it's no longer just, you know, maybe a bottom 10% of poor people. We're talking about even before this COVID hit, 40% of Americans didn't have $400 to meet an unexpected expense. And, you know, if that's 40% of Americans, now it's much higher. So it's becoming the norm to be financially struggling in America, the richest country in the world. It's just so incredibly unfair. You mentioned some things we could do about it in terms of the $600 bonus as kind of immediate money in the pockets of working people, adding to the unemployment. What would be some other specific policies that would put us on a path to recovery that's strong and broadly shared?
Sure. So, you know, I want to direct folks to our website, the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. We have a whole host of policy briefs up that describe how to build a better and fairer economy. I would just point out, we really need to improve worker power and worker voice. That includes strengthening unions, giving folks more workplace protections, and allowing workers to have self-determination over the conditions of their labor. We need to rewrite the tax code to not penalize workers' income and privilege investment income. We need to consider the distributional impact of our policies now. So because of the way the government puts out statistics, a lot of reporters will describe a thriving economy as one where our GDP was 2 or 3% last quarter, but we don't drill down to understand where that money is going. So my organization also has a program to improve the way that we measure progress so that we're actually capturing how real people are doing. And then the area that I focus on is financialization in Wall Street and breaking the power of the markets over the real economy. So there's several examples I've written about where Chipotle's stock was downgraded by Wall Street analysts because they raised their workers' pay. Or American Airlines stock was downgraded by analysts because they gave their unionized pilots a raise. And really, the market is designed to punish companies for treating workers like anything other than expendable expenses. So we really, there's a whole host of policies we can enact there to really break Wall Street's stranglehold over the real economy.
That's such a great example. And we had a guest on this show not that long ago, Dr. Zeynep Ten of MIT, who you might know, and she wrote a book called The Good Jobs Strategy. And it basically said for a company to really thrive, it's important to take good care of the workers, pay them well, treat them well. But most companies see workers as an expense and a negative thing. So, you know, that goes to business schools and how business executives are trained. So I think there's some major changes that need to happen throughout our system. And I'm glad you're working on it. And I'm curious, you were right there in the center of everything on Capitol Hill, and yet you chose to move to a think tank. What's your thinking there? Like, do you think you're going to have more impact shaping how people think more broadly, or in the heat of the battle on the Hill?
So I was on Capitol Hill 10 years. It's a really exhausting career, but incredibly rewarding. I was very lucky to work for some great members of Congress. It is not a place where you get to think your thoughts and really pause. You are always responding to the latest. I think folks, one thing I've been focused on is a real disinvestment from congressional capacity and staff over the last 40 years. That could be a whole separate conversation, but we don't invest in our staff. Staffs have shrunk. Folks would be surprised to know that it's mostly 25-year-olds making a lot of the recommendations to their bosses on Capitol Hill, but a lot of great people work there. I came to Equitable Growth right before the pandemic started, and my goal was to really think more long-term and be able to provide advice to policymakers on not what they need to do tomorrow, but 3 months, 6 months, 5 years. And I've found that, lawmakers really do need to rely on these external sources of information that are not bought and paid for by corporate interests to inform real evidence-based policymaking. And the last thing I'll say is that, lobbyists have unlimited deep pockets, and that translates into being able to ghostwrite bills, ghostwrite letters, write memos, and having a counterbalance to that sort of capacity to actually produce thinking that is in the public interest is really important.
That's fantastic. I so appreciate you taking your brilliance and knowledge and putting it to work to how we make America more resilient, more strong, with more shared prosperity. So thank you for everything that you did on the Hill and everything you're doing now at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth.
Thanks so much.
That's all the time we have. Amanda Fisher, thank you so much for being with us today.
Take care.
Stay tuned for our next guest.